January the 17th, 1972. We're in Tulsa at the Tulsa Historical Society area at the Tulsa City County Libraries, and I am visiting with Mrs. J. O. Mish.
Or Fannie B.
I want to get that. Our Fannie, F-A-N-N-I-E, B.
Brownlee.
Brownlee Mish, and Mish is spelled M-I-S-C-H. To start with, I want to find out where you were born and how you came, who your parents were, and how you came to Oklahoma.
I came to Kansas, to Parsons, Kansas, in 1904 with my parents, Edward and Rosella Brownlee, from Nottoway, Iowa. And I went to school in Kansas, was married in Kansas in 1909, but before that is when I taught school.
Yes. Well, now you taught school in the panhandle of Oklahoma, is that correct?
No, the panhandle of Texas and in Kansas.
Yeah, Texas and in Kansas.
Uh-huh, South Mound, Kansas, in Clarendon, Texas.
And your first book that you wrote, we'll be talking a little about the books you've written and what you're writing now, but the first book you wrote was dealt with teaching in the panhandle of Texas.
Yes, that was Teachers on Horseback.
Tell about a little about that book, what it was.
Well, it started out very briefly in Iowa, and then as a young woman, and then into Kansas, where I taught school, and then we decided to, another friend of mine decided we'd go to the panhandle of Texas and hunt a school if there was one vacant, and so we wrote to the county judge. They didn't have a superintendent in those days, and he said, come on, he had schools. So a young man was brought out to our home by his aunt, and her husband was a doctor, and said, would you take Willie along? Well, of course, we were growing up. We were about 18 years old, and so we said, yes, we'd take him along. So we went on the train with great big trucks, and we were out there a year, and it was a great experience.
Where was this?
I lived on a ranch about 20 miles out of Clarendon, Texas, and my friend lived in a dugout over on Fish Creek. But since the boy was younger than we let him have the one closest to town. He was only 10 miles out. We rode horseback to town on Saturday for the mail.
How far were you? Describe the school at that time.
Well, it was a one-room schoolhouse, and I drove 5 miles to school from the ranch and took the little boy along with me, and we took a 5-gallon jug of water because, of course, we had no well. And when it got down to 30 below, the ranch people wouldn't permit me to go to school because it said none of the kids would be there either.
What year was that you taught?
1908 and 1909.
How far were you from the Oklahoma Panhandle then?
Well, I was southeast of Amarillo on the Fort Worth in Denver. To go out there, we went down to Denison and up the railroad, up the Fort Worth in Denver.
When did you first get to Oklahoma? Come to Oklahoma?
In 1910.
And did you come to Tulsa?
I didn't come to live. My parents had moved here temporarily, and I was down here, but my husband and I went into business here in 1916.
And this was a printing business?
Printing and publishing.
The name of it was?
Tulsa Printing.
You mentioned printing and publishing. Of course, this publishing is an interesting thing. What were some of the books that you all published in your early days?
We published the 14 Forts of Oklahoma and the Choteau, magazines, and the Choteau book, The First White Settlement at Salina. We published that several years ago before I published this one. And log books for flyers, various kinds.
Why don't you describe the printing operation of 1916, what it was like, equipment you had and how you operated at that time?
Well, we operated very much the same as what we would now. We were always a letter press, and our place of business was at 219 East 3rd Street, and it was in the old Daniels building, which still stands, and it had wooden floors, and in order to hold the printing equipment and the presses, we had to put concrete reinforcements under the floors in that building. And then in 1922, we built a three-story building at 514 South Detroit and moved our plant down there in one of the businesses.
Did you remain letterpress?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever take an offset, or were you
Always letterpress. Always letterpress.
If you were going to business now, wouldn't you go into offset?
Perhaps, partly. I have a grandson in the business at Fulton, Missouri, and they're going into offset. They had been all letterpress, and he says that that's the thing to do. But where my son works, they, with the All Capital, they have both.
Most of them do now. Mm-hmm. Probably most printing.
And some of them have all offset, you see.
Yes, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. In fact, the trend is that direction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The book that you wrote that we wanted to discuss a little was the book Methodist Trails.
It starts in England.
Yeah. Why don't you, of course, the thing that we are most interested in is the Oklahoma portion.
Well, that's
But you want to be able to end
that.
Why don't you tell us a little about that?
Well, this book, there's 145 pages, and there's 65 photographs, and the trail starts in England with John Wesley and his mother, and they started the Christ Church called the Holy Club in England, and they were made fun of, and then eventually he was sorry for the people in prison and all the debtors over there, and he came here with Oglethorpe when Oglethorpe came in 1703, and George Whitefield came with them, but the Wesleys didn't stay indefinitely, and they went back to England, and the Methodist Church, though, was established then at that point. It was grew from that. Other people of the Methodists came over. It said the institutions of Methodism grew like a tall palm, and the official system grew as noiselessly. And I'll go on to the five tribes in the southeast. The Creek Indians were the first settlers which Oglethorpe found when they came there, and Tomachichi, the Creek chief, welcomed them, and they helped him establish the colony around Savannah. Anyway, the missionaries came, and the Mississippi Conference sent missionaries to the Chickasaws and Choctaws and the Creeks and the Cherokees. And I go into detail, of course, in the book, which is more particularly of interest to the church people. I'll just skip along here. The first Asbury Mission was at North Falktown in 1848, and Norfolk Town was a forerunner of Eufaula. When the Methodist Trails reached Tulsa, it was in 1886, and a conference of Methodism was held at Chautauqua, Kansas in 85, October the 20th, 22. And it was a momentous occasion for Tulsa, Creek Nation, Indian Territory. And at that time, Tulsa Red Fork was added as new, Tulsa and Red Fork were added as new mission fields, as well as were Red Rock, Bartlesville, Red Jacket, Ponca, Oto, and Kaw agencies. Church stations already working were one church and parsonage at Wyandotte, stations at Snow Creek, and one at Panther Creek, Sunday schools at these churches, and stations with Sunday schools only total seven. In December 1886, the First Methodist Episcopal Church was organized in Tulsa Town, And this was the first church ever built in Tulsa. There was a Presbyterian mission was erected and church services held there several years prior to that, about 1883, I believe, or 84. But this church was organized with just a few Indians present. Legus Perryman was the principal chief of the Creek Indians in this area at that time. He was very cooperative. In fact, he paid $10 for occupancy right to the ground which the little church was built on, would be on North Main Street between Cameron and the Katy Railroad track, which at that time was called Duluth. The streets there are Brady, Cameron, and Duluth, and run alphabetically north. It soon outgrew that location, and a location south.
What is the relationship, incidentally, of Legus Perryman to Mr. Perryman we met this morning?
It's his grandfather. Mm-hmm. And he raised Homer. That's Homer. Mm-hmm. Homer's father was killed in an accident. Well, anyhow, the congregation decided, part of them, they split up. Some remained on the north side of town. The others came on the hill south of the railroad, which was at the northeast corner of Boulder and Fifth Street. At that time, this was an interesting thing, that in 1906, about the time this church was built, 1905, or started, was when the Creek Indians was to hold their last council session in the historic capital in Okmulgee before terminating their tribal relations before statehood. And also, Tulsa was soon to have mail delivery, and the carrier would ring a cowbell when a patron had a letter. The Indian Republican stated that the cattlemen were cheerful. Since grass all over the territory was excellent, they looked to the weatherman for relief and not to the government. When Reverend Abel came to occupy the church on April the 7th, 2nd, 1917, the Boston Avenue Church was to be invited to combine services during pastors and vacations. And 4 days after this board meeting on April the 6th, war was declared by President Woodrow Wilson. Tulsa County was swiftly mobilized. Captain LaRue opened a recruiting tent on the southeast corner of 4th and South Main, a vacant lot, later to be known as Liberty Square, where bonds were sold.
Now, we're getting into the area where you are here. You came here in 1916. Tell us about Reverend Abel, Dr. J.W. Abel. Tell us, not reading, but I just want you to tell about this person.
Well, he was known as the fighting pastor because he was out doing other things besides just church work. He cooperated. He belonged to the Kiwanis Club, and he soon saw that the church building, which he was then preaching, was going to have to be enlarged, which was impossible in that location, or else build farther out. And they bought a lot at 6th and Boulder, which is now the Court Arcade Building. It was purchased by Mr. Aronson, who is a trustee of this library.
Yes, we have an interview with
him. Uh-huh. And anyway,
why don't you tell us, I'm trying to get away from the book, more informal. I will go back to the book, though. Why don't you talk a little about what it was like at the time? Give us a little bit, in your own words and thoughts, of the tenor of thinking at the beginning of World War I. You were here then.
Well, there was 500 boy reserves, which were mobilized to work on the farms to relieve the boys, the soldier men, the services, and we had a big revival that year, and 500 new people joined the church, in that little church.
Do you attribute any of that to the feeling, the war feeling, or some of the...
I think it was the expanding population. And between the groundbreaking and the entering of the new church location, a tragedy struck in Tulsa. Just at supper time on a pleasant evening, the race riot was started.
Did you see any of that?
I won't tell about much of it.
I lived to it pretty close. Well, that's why it ought to be recorded, you know.
About supper time on a pleasant evening, May 31st, a disastrous racial war started when two carloads of Negro men stopped by the courthouse to, reportedly, they said, to release a prisoner in the top floor of the courthouse. And they were all armed with shotguns. And it was just at the time that some of the stores were closing. It was very quiet over town. Some of the stores had closed. Well, of course, the citizens, white citizens, quickly armed. They broke into all the stores, took out all the ammunition, guns, hardware of all kinds, and the real battle started at the railroad stations. Trains didn't go in here, through here for 3 days. Of course, martial law was quickly declared, and there was an engineer and a fireman killed in their cab on the train. That's why they stopped the trains. And of course, about 800 houses burned. And Reverend Abel had them set up with their several. The Red Cross came in here from quite a few towns to take over because, of course, so many people were burned up and their homes burned up. And it burned for days, 3 or 4 days. And of course, martial law was declared, and you had to lay on the floor. You couldn't lay in front of a window. But anyway, he set up a Red Cross station in our basement of that church. And the refugees and wounded were taken down there and cared for. And another thing that outside of the race riot that happened that was kind of interesting, especially in the present day, that Amos Hall was a janitor, and he lived in that basement, and he studied his law books, and he became a well-qualified Negro attorney here, and just recently died, perhaps in the last 2 or 3 months, and he was district court judge, I believe. Wrote it down. Yes, he was a district court judge at the time of his death, but he got his start studying law in this little church basement. And anyway, when the new church was started at 11th and Boulder, and we had this, we lived in the basement of the church for several years because it was quite a job, and it was finished under Dr. Skinner from New York when Dr. Abel left. And when they marched down on that day, I was trying to think of the... Oh, yes, in this basement of this little church, they also, Reverend Abel had a Boy Scout troop meet in there. He did all sorts of things. And then in the race riot, he and our assistant pastor got on boxes in the street and shouted and begged and pled for a quiet, you know, and restraint. And anyway...
Did he do any good?
Well, I suppose it did some good, but of course they went off and left him, you know. And
I want to get back a little on Amos Hall. Wasn't Amos Hall the first Negro judge in Oklahoma? Am I correct or not?
Well, Ben Hill, you know, he just died lately.
Yes, I know.
And he was a legislator.
Hill was a legislator, mm-hmm. But wasn't Hall the first?
Well, I'm not sure about that. He's the first one I remember about.
You knew him, apparently, because...
I talked to him on the phone when I wrote this book.
Oh, you were not well acquainted.
I wasn't well acquainted with him, but a friend of mine was his court reporter. She lives in Sepulpa, but she works over here. And anyway, the two rooms in this lower level auditorium in this little church seated 1,600. And I was going to say that when this I want to turn here because I want to get it correct here. Let's see. It's about the war. Anyway, it's interesting about this war. The entire football team, am I still on? The entire football team at Kendall College enlisted at one time as students from Central High and businessmen, and E.W. Sinclair gave $10,000 to rebuild buildings at the fairgrounds to house these men, which became Camp St. Clair, and the Oklahoma Ambulance Company was to be a part of the sanitary train and the Rainbow Division. And anyway, this is what I was looking for. On Sunday morning, May the 31st, 1918, the Wesley Sunday School class, of which I and my husband were members, of 250 members, were assembled in the balcony seats. Ralph Kissler, the teacher, solemnly announced that on March the 29th, Good Friday, Big Bertha, the long-range cannon of the Germans had fired on Paris from the hill 75 miles distant. Members were stunned at first, then dropped to their knees to pray. 86 young men from Tulsa First Methodist Church were in service, and many over there. The German attacks lasted till July every 3 days, which brought them once more to the Marne. When Armistice Day came on November 11th, that fall, the first church had three casualties, George Rowe, Carol Morford, and Lee Gillespie. And after the close of the war, in spite of all the hardships, this little church gave $68,000 to the Centenary Missionary Campaign. Now then, they sold the property, and after this other deal, the race riot, the last service held on the Fifth Street Church was Sunday of Thanksgiving week, 1921. December 4th arrived. To many Tulsans, it was just a pleasant winter day on a quiet Sunday morning. To First Methodist folks, it was the great day. The large congregation gathered early at the red brick church to cast looks of nostalgia at the pretty windows and the tall spire for the last time. The official board, trustees, and other officers soon started the historical Methodist trail to the new First Church, Tulsa, marching four abreast, led by a jazz marching band playing stirring hymns. The singing was led by Homer Rodehever, soloist for the Billy Sunday Revivals being held in Tulsa. Babes in Arms and Cradle Roll registrants rode in buggies or cars the whole six blocks distant. And when we had the 75th anniversary, which I spent a year working on this book for, the Tulsa Police Department closed Boulder Avenue, and we went to that corner and made that historic march again in 61.
Were you there on the first one?
Oh, yes.
You were there both?
Oh, yes.
Why don't you talk about the experience of being in that march? Just that first one, not the second.
Well, of course, it was looking forward to something big. All the people in Tulsa at that time thought it was going to get bigger and better. There were some people, of course, who didn't think so. So we had outgrown the church. It was simply bursting at the seams and standing room only. And, of course, we run into the Depression with the cathedral. And in the little first church, we had the first pipe organ in Tulsa. And it was moved to the lower level of the new church. But it was... Well, it was a wonderful experience because people had contributed heavily financially and worked hard to raise the funds to make this change.
The you want to go on from there on this other?
Well,
why don't you tell us?
This church is called the Cathedral of the Southwest, and the place where it's located is called Cathedral Square, and on that square is a park, and the First Christian Church, and the First Methodist Church, and the Christian Science Church, and then you see, the First Methodist Episcopal Church that was established here, there was a break in Methodism in the Civil War over the freeing of the Negroes. And so after about 48, there were no Methodist Episcopal churches here until ours was the first one here.
Tell us, what is the, where did Boston Avenue come from?
They were established about 1893, I believe, and their location was on Boulder, up there just north of the tracks, about even where the old convention hall is, the South Acadia Tracks. They had Sunday school, and their preacher lived in a dugout.
What was it called then?
It was called Methodist Church South.
Mm-hmm. And it became Boston Avenue Methodist when they moved to Boston.
And when we were in the brick church at 5th and Boulder, the First Christian Church was on the corner just north of us.
You're writing now a history of the Old Creek area and of early Tulsa, based mainly on its Creek background, isn't that right?
Oh yes, it starts in the southeastern states, or starts back about 1500, some of it does, and then to the Indians in the southeastern states and their cause for removal and Andrew Jackson and Jeffrey.
You say 1500s?
Mm-hmm. Some of them came over from Scotland way back there.
Yes, but. Okay, and
maybe I'm mistaken there.
No, you may be right. You're right. I'm sure. But I was surprised. I didn't realize it. I didn't realize your book would start back that.
Well, it starts back with the settlers that came in with Oglethorpe. When Oglethorpe came in, Chief Tomatucci met them and they helped establish the colony. The book then goes back at the early history of some of the later settlers that were 1500. The book part itself don't start until with Oglethorpe, 1735.
Yes. Now, it includes the Trail of Tears movement across, I guess.
Well, yes, of course, there are a lot of Trail of Tears, you know, all the tribes, and all of them had more than one trail. But it extends into the Creek Nation. And of course, it includes the white settlers, and it includes some of the Cherokees spill into it, and the Osages.
Why don't you tell a little bit about the very early settlement of Tulsa, with the early Creek, the original Creek, as your.
Well, it was settled in 1882 when the railroad came here, and the first winter. The men, there was about 10, I think. I have the picture of the tents the businessmen were in. The doctor had one tent, and the general store was another tent, and the boarding tent. But they couldn't go on and build because it came in about August. The first store was established in August of 82. And
who had that?
George Bullitt and his wife. And they hauled in a wagon their groceries down from Coffeyville, Kansas. Most of the things were hauled in from Coffeyville, Kansas, or else down the river to Orleans and up this way. And then they had a Creek uprising called the Green Peach War. And yet they had a little civil war among themselves, and so they couldn't couldn't do any building till spring. And they lived in tents all winter. And the man that fed the, furnished the supplies for the railroad, he built a store, and
that was
J.M. Hall.
Yeah.
And Bullitt, he quickly went into the farming business. He didn't have his little store very long. That's why so many people...
Hall was the first permanent store.
He was the first... Well, he and...
Archer.
And Archer. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman that you talked to out here, Homer Perryman, his grandfather lived and by a spring, which the location now is under this First Methodist Cathedral at Levington Boulder. There's Mr. Bullock and his wife.
Yes.
And the first church was held in that Brush Arbor. Mm-hmm. This was a interpreter. See, these churches here all had to have interpreters.
Yes.
And we had two. We had a Creek and a Cherokee.
Now, although 1882 was the beginning of Tulsa with its white settlement, of course, why don't you tell about the first Creek settlement?
Well, the Creeks came up here in 1848. They were down, that was the Perryman clan. And they'd been down to Big Spring, northeast of Broken Arrow, and they had smallpox down there, so they moved out and came up and settled along the river up here. And there was an early Presbyterian mission established among the Creeks at Coweta, and they established a branch of that mission on this Tulsa Council ground site, which our city is about to acquire a whole block with the Council Oak, and in 48. So there was a branch Presbyterian church here that early. That is, I don't know if there was a church building,
yes,
but they probably held it under Brush Arbors or in the homes. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Loomis, who was called the Christian commander at Fort Gibson, he had been a missionary to China. He was the one who made that statement in his scenes in the Indian Territory that they had this Presbyterian mission established here in 48. But of course they came up to this council ground and had their council meetings right after 28, because the first Creeks came out here in 28. They left Georgia in 27 and arrived here in February.
How did you become interested in the Creeks?
Well, of course it's a Creek town, and we always knew it was. And there were Creeks all around us. And
yes.
I have lots of Indian friends. I have Osages and Creeks and Cherokee friends. And like I said in the introduction to my book, you couldn't exclude some of the other tribes out of the history of the Creeks. It'd be like writing a genealogical tree and leaving out all the in-laws.
Actually, what's now Tulsa is part Creek. Now in part Cherokee.
And Osage. We spill over into Osage. Yes, you see, the Cherokee line is right up here, 5th and North Main. And I have friends that I interviewed, and I knew their mother before she died, and they had a 10-story brick house, and they were Cherokees. And they cooked on the Creek side of the house and slept on the Cherokee side, right on the line.
You say a 10-story brick house?
A 10-room, I meant. I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. The
10 rooms. It was a red brick, and it was just burned down about last year when some tramps got in and set it afire.
I understand that the old hall and Archer store was just recently torn down. Isn't that right?
No.
It was the first permanent building. Which was this permanent building that was torn down about a year or so ago in the renewal area?
Oh, you're talking about the rock building at first? Well, that was built by Bob Lynch. That was the first rock building, built in 94. See, these others were built earlier.
Tell about the Lynch store.
Well, the rock from that, I have a rock out on my back, on my front porch now that I salvaged to save, and I've also got a rock from the Asbury Mission. I went down there and cased all that before it went under the Eufaula Dam. But anyway, the Lynch building was built by Colonel L.D. Lindsay. He was a captain in the Ohio Cavalry, and he came in the South Country. He went to Birmingham, and then he came out here, did a lot of construction in this area, and that was his first building he built in Tulsa. And the Lynches had a frame building.
Lynch. You were talking about the Lynch's building.
Yes, well, they got the rock of the quarry out at Dalton and hauled it in here, and it was two stories and a full basement. And they, C.B. Lynch and Bob had owned, Bob had come up here, pardon me, to work on the Hossel Ranch. And he and his brother were in business in a frame building, but they moved it off the lot, and Bob, he built the rock building. And Andy Stokes, who was later a setter in Tulsa, he and his wife came over from Claremore and opened up an ice cream parlor in the basement. And they had a windmill out the side on First Street with a water tank for the horses. And upstairs was, it was really kind of like the Tulsa Civic Center, is where they had lodge meetings and all kinds of gatherings met up there in that upstairs. Had an outside entrance, and had an outside entrance to the basement. And he had all kinds of everything from sewing machines to ribbon. And the people, the dealers in those days, would go out with a wagon to the countryside among the Indians and the white settlers, and they'd haul organs and sewing machines to sell. They'd go out and just peddle them. And we had pack peddlers coming through the country, and they had to have a license, and these merchants had to have a license. They had to get a permit from the Creek Nation to open a store, you know, and an Indian, a white man couldn't work for an Indian without a permit, a written permit. That's the way they raised some of their money.
The could you tell a little about beyond now this first store, the Lynch store was the first store. Tell a little about what followed the Lynch store in the building of Tulsa.
The next rock building was the Livery Barn. That's what it was called, the Rock Barn. They'd have badger fights and everything else there when they weren't but they had lots of horses.
How about the badger fights?
Well, they advertised those, but they said in the paper, and it said, but leave your guns at home. And the Indians were great horse racers. They always had nice horse ponies. This man keeps walking back and forth. But anyway, the doctors and the people of affluence that could afford them, they brought in Kentucky bred horses. They had wonderful horses. And a pioneer cattleman later bought that rock building, and it was built in the beginning by Barry Hogan. And just after he sold it, he was boarding 30 fine horses down in the basement. And the fire marshal, Chief Alder, gave him some worn-out rubber hose to make treads on the ramp so that they could take the horses down the ramp. And they caught fire and burned up 30 of those fine horses.
Tell a little about the badger fights this year.
Well, I didn't see those.
No, I know you did. I presume, though, that you have done some research on that.
Well, not to any great extent. The next building that was the cotton gin, and well, his first was a mill where a man out southeast had a lot of corn, and he had no way to grind it, so he established a corn grinding mill on out further on West First Street. And some enterprising man in the mill, he hooked up a rig to have a bathhouse hooked up to the boiler, and the ladies could go during the week, but Saturday night was men's day, and they buy tickets for it. Four for a dollar, I think.
Can you tell any more about that or describe it?
Well, then it was later made into a flour mill, and of course later we had other mills, and we had stockyards built, and the town developed.
Mm-hmm. The what about the paving of the town? When did that begin to take place, and what happened there?
I don't know. They used Montgomery Ward catalogs and corn cobs for a long time. But I really, just offhand, without looking at my notes, I don't remember when the first paving went in, but it was here, some of it, when I came in 1910. But West Edison, I live close to Gilcrease now, and out there wasn't paved. But when I came down in 1910, the 1000 block on South Main was where my parents were living, and we had to walk out there, and we thought it was terribly far out, and the thing to see then was the new Midland Valley Depot, and we just walked all over town. My brother took me around, and then a farmer from Kansas came down on South, looked around South Peoria about 31st Street, and he had to visit his sister here, and he wanted to buy a farm, but he said 31st and South Peoria was just too far out. He wasn't interested.
How did they use Montgomery Ward catalog?
Hmm?
Did they use the full catalog?
Well, the ladies, when they crossed the street, they'd tear the pages out, and they'd put it down and step, and then they'd put another one down and step to get across the street to the stores, because it was just very muddy. In fact, old Dr. Wilson, the first dentist here, he got as far as Tulsa from up the road, I believe it was Oshaleta. Anyway, he was up there. He was traveling through the country, had his dental equipment with him in his buggy, and he got here and he couldn't get any farther, so he had to stay till spring, so he never did leave.
That's how he happened to settle in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
Where was he going to?
Oh, he was just hunting a location, and he was traveling around, but he got this far, he couldn't make it any farther. It was too muddy.
You think that's how Tulsa got settled? He couldn't get any farther?
That's how Dr. Wilson stayed. I interviewed him. See, I've interviewed a lot of these old pioneers.
Is that how your printing plant got started?
No, we came in on the railroad.
Who are some of the people you interviewed?
Oh, I don't know. It's a long list of them. I've interviewed a lot of the Cherokees and the Osages.
In the area of Tulsa history, who are some of the people you interviewed?
Oh, Dr. Clinton and Dr. Wilson, the dentist, and the McBurney family. And then, of course, for this book, I interviewed many. It took me a year, and I wrote from coast to coast. The Methodist Church didn't have a single photograph in their files when I started to write that book. I wrote to nursing homes and business places and bishops and all over the country. But down here in Tulsa, I've interviewed a lot of early photographers and a lot of the pioneer people. Heffelfingers and Lynches and Perrymans and Mrs. Lindsay. I own Mrs. Lindsay's entire collection there. Memorial Association at Oklahoma City is considering buying it when I get ready to sell it.
Do you have any funny stories in your book that are going to come out? You can think of it.
Well, I don't know right now. There's so much in it that I hadn't thought about that before it came in.
When do you hope to have your book out?
Well, I hope to have it ready. Of course, I asked for an extension of time. I hope to have it out in the spring.
I want to leave you my card, because when it comes out, I want to know, because I want to get one, I want to buy one, and I also am going to get you to autograph it.
Oh, well, I've had a lot of people, and a lot of the, you asked me about the Porters, were some other people I interviewed. You see, Bill Porter, he keeps nagging me. Why don't, he says, we Creeks are getting awful tired of waiting on you on that. But his grandfather was a principal chief of the Creeks just before statehood.
What's the funniest story you have in your book? To you.
Oh, I just don't know. I can't think of any.
There must be something funny in it.
Well, one was when I think of was a Catholic man, a priest, was going to a meeting down in the Fort Gibson and West area, and he was late going, and he had his accoutrements with him to conduct this Catholic service when he got there, and so they assigned the job of driving him over to the meeting to a little boy or youngster. And he was worried so worried about these accoutrements that he had that somebody would waylay them and rob them. And he kept talking about it, and this lad said, "Don't worry, sir." He said, "There isn't a white man within 50 miles." Mm-hmm. In other words, the Indians wouldn't bother him.
Yeah. That's a good story. This gets into, I think, the basic character of the Indians' honesty, which has been. Do you have any other examples that would portray the basic honesty that was attributed, and I assume correctly, to the tribal Indian? Can you think of any other stories along that line?
Well, of course, it was the Indian agents always said that if an Indian gave his word, it was good. I mean, he always, even the some of the hostile creeks, which were the upper creeks and created the Civil War, which drove the early creeks out here, they always said if they gave their word, they kept it.
Do you have any personal examples in your personal experience that might deal in this area?
You mean about honesty?
Yes, uh-huh. Or in any other area that might reflect the personality, character, or otherwise of the Indians.
Well, this Lila Lindsay that I hope to do a juvenile on, that's the reason I can't turn loose the collection right now. Her ambition was to go to college, go away to school. Of course, all the children that showed ability, if it was possible, they were sent to the States to school. And I made a trip to North Missouri last fall and to see the college where this Creek Indian orphan girl was sent to by the missionaries from Tallahassee Creek Mission School. And her ambition had always been to go to school and acquire an education and come back and help her people. And her father died at Fort Gibson in the Civil War, and her mother was, they called her a medicine woman. That was a misnomer as far as reality. She just went around when people were sick and used the herbs and the medicines at hand. She didn't intimate that she had any powers at all, not like the medicine man we hear about. And she died when Lotta was about 13, so she was free to go to school. And she went to the Synodical College. I was up there and had the material from there to put in my book on her. And she graduated then from Hillsborough College in Ohio, and they didn't think a bachelor's degree should be given to a girl, and they didn't have, so they created a master's degree for her. Well, she came back. She married this man that built the Rock Building, this Colonel Lindsay. She's known as Lila Denton Lindsay. And she's in the Oklahoma Hall of Fame, by the way. And she probably did more than any other, I'm sure she did more than any Indian woman for the upbuilding of Tulsa. She organized. There were very few things that were organized in Tulsa that she didn't have a hand in, from the Women's Christian Temperance Union to the Indian Women's Clubs to the civic affairs to the welfare, getting a matron appointed. And her allotment, 40 acres of it, was down here in southwest Tulsa, about 8 or 9 blocks from here. And then she had the other part of her allotment. An Indian could take their allotment. They could have 40 acres for a homestead, which was they couldn't sell, and then the rest of it they could take somewhere else. Now, her others were out where the Keystone Lake is. Now it's on the Cimarron. And she taught the first, she taught in the first private school in Tulsa. I have one of the chairs that she and her husband bought in my collection in that first school, and they wandered in the public schools she taught. She taught at Oak Mug in the council house, and substituted for Alice Robinson, and for a little church out close to Broken Arrow called the Fight Church, which is still in existence. And she's kin to the Perrymans and the Porters.
Is she living now?
No, she died in 46. She was a personal friend of mine. And I purchased her material. I've tried to keep everything in Oklahoma of hers. I purchased one from a man in Tacoma, a whole bunch. And then I've acquired others from different estates where they had letters and so forth. But that's just typical of, she was an outstanding woman in that way. Her father was a Cherokee, her mother was a Creek, and of course the children always went on the rolls of their mother. All the tribes did. I mean, there was a matriarchal line.
How did you become interested in writing?
Oh, I started writing, I guess, 30 years ago. I wrote short features, and I've written for the national magazines, and I've written about 80 illustrated historical features. Some of them are not. I've written for Gilcrease and the Tulsa Papers and Farmer Stockman and Oklahoma Today and others, poetry journals. And, was on the staff writer for the Christian Woman in Wichita during World War II. Of course, my husband was ill for 2 years, and I run the shop. My son was in the submarine service, so I've had a pretty active career.
Now, what books have you had published? You mentioned you have your Methodist Trails, you have your Women on Horseback.
But Sam Houston is ready, but it isn't published. I haven't tried to yet. I have the location, which has been very controversial. The legislature's been trying to establish a marker, but they can't agree on it. I've got it all figured out, even the legal descriptions. But the man that owns the property wouldn't let him put it's off the main road. They can't get a marker on his property. But my husband and I were both listed in Who's Who in Tulsa in 65, and I'm in Who's Who in American Women, and also in the Dictionary of International Biography in London for my research. And of course, I was quite active in the Federation of Women's Clubs for years. I was, for 15 years, for the first district, I was publicity chairman, and then in 48 to 50, I was the state publicity chairman, and I won the New York Herald and Tribune award for the best publicity in the state that year. And then I wrote a news release for 2 years, once a month, for WNAD at Norman. I was asked to come and give it, but I didn't do it. I just mailed it.
How many pictures do you have in your collection?
About 800.
About 800. Mm-hmm.
We have a nice library. My husband's library and mine are different. Mine's Southwest and Indians, and his is the World Wars and the Generals and the Presidents. Mm-hmm.
How many, now your husband died, did you say?
About a year and a half ago. I have one son and one daughter, and eight great-grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Eight great-grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's tremendous. How many of these pictures are going to be in your Oklahoma?
Well, of course, that'll be up pretty much to the editor, but I hope about 500 or something like that, or six. That one, same man.
I might check and see if he has a problem. I'll be right back. Now, talking about her family now, just kind of visiting, you know.
Well, my son was in the submarine service on the Sea Dog for 4 years during World War II, and my daughter is married and lives in Colterville, Kansas, and she has eight grandchildren. I just have five. So I went up to see my greats last fall, and I took a busman's holiday because I report every 2 weeks for the Forest Review in Chicago, and I visited the forest shops there, and found one that had been in existence in the family since before the Civil War at Fulton. And my grandson works for the Bell Publishing Company there, and so that is a lot of fun going through that plant. He's part owner there. And then I went to St. Louis, and I went down to the Mississippi River to visit where Lewis and Clark came back in their replica of their canoes there when they came back from the Lewis and Clark expedition, and the old Choteau mansion, and the Cleeds fur trading post or where they started their furs.
What to you is the biggest thing that's happened in Tulsa since you've been here, since 1960?
Oh, the thing I've looked forward to for years and years was the Port of Catoosa.
Were you there for the dedication?
Oh, I know. It was such a big crowd, and I knew I'd have to walk so far, so my son took me out early the next morning because I wanted to view it and take some pictures and see the, the boats. Mm-hmm. And this Lila Lindsay I was telling you about, she was on the National Rivers and Harbors Committee from the government, and I've been hearing about that deal for all these years, and it's been my ambition to live to see that. That was the highlight for me in Tulsa.
What about Spavinaugh? That was a big...
Well, that was a great deal, and everybody but us, I think, had a dance that night. But I went out visiting, and everybody was pulling their carpets up and getting ready to have a dance. That really was something, because... Of course, so when I first came to Tulsa, I had a small, this daughter was 2 years old, and we had to save the ice drips from the ice box to bathe the babies in, It was so muddy, and of course, we had to see their Creek Indians were out here by Sand Springs, and they had these three springs, which people, after the Indians left there, people sold a bottle of water. A man bought up that spring. There were three springs. Town's named after it. Paving's over now. And so everybody bought bottled water, 5-gallon jugs.
What about the oil? You were here during the period that the big oil company...
Glenn Poole.
You weren't here when Glenn Poole was discovered, though.
No, I was here in Tan. I might tell you a little odd thing that happened when... the city service was building their big building down here. I knew that they bought the ground where there had been an old gas well. So I got in touch with them and told them it was there and they'd better watch out for it. So they sent a man down to my office and he said, could you locate it? And I said, well, I know the people's name who lived within a certain few feet of it if you get your abstract out. So anyway, they kept, I located within 50 feet, and that story was carried on the United Press, but they kept me informed every few days as to how far down they were when they hit the first top of the wooden plug. It was just an old, almost decayed plug, and they cased it in down by 500 feet. And then when the Oklahoma Natural bought this place on West 3rd Street for the build that big heating and cooling unit, I called and told them they'd bought a cemetery, the first Tulsa cemetery. So they the next day, they in the legal news, they had, if anybody had graves there, they would be careful and rebury them, and they buried some in Sand Springs.
That's this new big city service. New one that they just built, is that right?
Yeah, they came down from Barnesville.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The
Bank of Commerce is in that now, and that's one of the early banks. And then where the First National Bank is now, they're right on top of where there used to be a windmill up here at 4th and, it's 5th and Boulder, isn't it?
Well, let's think of some of the other things and what used to be there. Let's take the Civic Center area, what used to be here. Say where the library is today. What was there, do you know?
Oh, what was there? Well, they're just houses.
Just houses.
Just houses, and the Urban Renewal took them down. Everybody was mad, of course, just like that lady on television at noon that back east that she won't move out of her house. But, of course, most of them did. Oh, that was all just built-up houses.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other buildings in town or landmark buildings that are over things that might have been particular interest? You mentioned the cemetery and the gas well.
Well, in a building now that is standing at about 2 doors north of 2nd Street, if they haven't torn it down since I saw it a week or so ago, there's a city water well that you can look down in from a closet, I'm told. I didn't see it, but one of my pioneer friends told me that that's over a water well. And it hasn't been filled up. Of course, some of the water wells have been filled up.
Speaking of that gas well, what's City Service doing with it? Are they pumping anything out of it?
Oh, no, they plugged it up. But it wasn't well plugged. It just had an old piece of board in it. And in the early days, when that thing was first opened up, everybody around kind of knew about it, but I don't think anybody thought, not everybody either, but several did. But they had a pipe on it with a tin can over it, and when people would be coming to town, they'd take them down there to show them and take the can off and turn the valve and light it, you know, and scare everybody to death. It was quite a deal. And somebody coming in from the Osage saw one of that one night, and they thought the town was on fire.
You've been here a lot of years, and I've known an awful lot of people. Let's take some of the leaders in Tulsa and let me name a few, and then you'll know a lot more that I wouldn't name. That.
May I ask you? Well, that's turned on.
No, it's on. Go ahead, ma'am.
And I was going to ask you what happens to all this stuff.
Well, this, of course, is that's why I was hoping you'd come to our meeting tonight, you know,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sorry you can't. But, of course, one thing is that, of course, this is good research material for the future all over Oklahoma. See,
mm-hmm.
This may be used many years hence, you know, mm-hmm. you never can tell.
But
the
other thing,
to be deposited. The Oklahoma Historical Society and the Oklahoma Christian College,
mm-hmm.
where we conduct it,
mm-hmm.
it's a joint project of
mm-hmm.
the two. But in addition, we work in the audiovisual area where we're putting together programs, and I have this one which is called Tulsa Town tonight, and it starts.
Is that the one that Beryl Ford's pictures?
It's the one that has Beryl Ford's pictures. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts.
I've seen his pictures.
You've seen the.
Not all of them. But
the real key to this, I'm going to turn this off for time. So.
I didn't know him personally. Uh-huh. My husband was in Kansas City Hospital so long. He's
uh-huh.
in the room next to Mr.
Oh.
Mitch. I've been places where he was, but I didn't know him personally.
Who among the leaders in Tulsa that you can think of did you know personally pretty well?
I knew the Vandivers.
Why don't you tell us about them? You know, just as you knew them, things that you might think about.
Well, I knew them when they had the little store down on First Street.
That was their first store.
Mm-hmm.
Tell about the first Vandiver store.
Well, when I first shopped there, they had the little baskets that you put your, they clerk put the money in and pulled a little string and it went up the upper region somewhere to get your change. And it just had all kinds of merchandise and they were all just on one floor. I mean, the piece goods and the dress goods, and of course they were in business up until just about this last year. They went out of business, you know. I knew Luella real well. She just died about 2 months ago.
Who else among the earlier leaders of Tulsa did you know? Did you know any of the oil families in Tulsa?
Well, let's see. It's been so long since I came. I, of course, knew particularly the people in the Kiwanis Club and the Chamber of Commerce, and the first president was Johnny Woodard, a lawyer of the Kiwanis Club, and of course I knew everybody in the printing industry, because in those days we had picnics and dinners and
mm-hmm.
got together. They don't do that anymore, you know.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Things have changed.
What about of those people that you knew who were leaders in the building of Tulsa, who stand out?
Dr. Fred Clinton.
Tell about him.
Creek. Well, he was one of the early doctors, and he was the one that brought in the Red Fork oil well, the first one, and he had the first hospital, he and Dr. Ziegler, and it was on West 5th Street, about Lawton, where the road turn went down towards the bridge. Of course, that's all changed now. And I did a feature story on that and had a picture of it in the paper quite a few years ago.
Yes,
and he built the first fireproof building. I believe it was at about 5th and Boston. They moved a house off and down at 16th and Denver. And when they were tearing it down, I did a story on that and wrote about this. It was several stories, probably 8 or 9 stories.
Can you talk about him as a personality?
Yes, he was a large man, very imposing, and he was very busy. He was one of the railroad physicians here, and he married a lady from Georgia. She passed away, and his second wife, Beulah, she's still living in Tulsa. And he was a brother of Mrs. Jim McBurney, whose husband was one of the first bankers in the Bank of Commerce here. And he was also, McBurney was the director. His picture's in here in my book. And Dr. Clinton was very prominent in all civic affairs. And he, when they had wrecks and catastrophes, he'd work day and night. They'd bring him in here. Had one between here and Sapulpa, a very bad wreck. And the of course, they just had little frame hospitals, you know.
What other individuals stand out?
Oh, Mr. Music, who was invited to come and give an interview today, he came here in 98. He owns the Denver Village up here. He's a prescription man. He has a drugstore. And he's had done a lot of research, and he remembers it all. And he was taken care of part of the time when he's a little boy by this Lila Lindsay, this missionary teacher. And he has recorded lots of the Tulsa history, and he's been in the drugstore. He was in the old early Shackle drugstore here. And he, earlier when he was a kid like, he worked on a ranch. He said he, one time he rode a horse to a race ring event down around Broken Arrow, I think, and his horse won, and it was loaned to him by the man he worked for, and after it won the race, before he got home, somebody stole it.
We need to interview Mr.
Yeah, but he said he had so many people out of the store on account of the flu that he couldn't. He planned to come tonight, perhaps.
Yes.
That's what Dorothy told me.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other individuals?
Well, of course, you know about Charlie Border. I've known him since the year one.
About him. We did an interview with him, but we've once talked about him.
Well, of course, he's connected with the Chamber of Commerce for many years, and then, of course, on this Port of Catoosa deal, you know all about that. Everybody that knows Charlie Barton knows that. He's got a nice wife named Rose, and she writes for children. And I don't know much else to say about him except that I always think of him as either connection with the river navigation or with the Chamber of Commerce, wouldn't you say so?
Do you think of any other individuals who stand out? Was your husband, was your shop the oldest shop?
It was one of the oldest. It wasn't the oldest one.
Uh-huh.
There was a, it's the oldest Tulsa printing shop. We came here in 16, and he retired, and my son and I run it the last few years. And one of the early printers here in town was Richard Burkhart. They had a beautiful home on the north side, which... and then the daughter run his print shop later. But one of the things that stands out in my mind, and I, without my notes, I couldn't tell the exact dates, were the booster trips. They were really something.
Tell about those.
Well, one of the very earliest ones, the people went, they paid $100. They got a private car, and they had a printing press in it, and they printed little news sheets along the way. They got into Chicago, and they got on the floor with a band in the Board of Trade, and they stopped the trade. They couldn't carry on. Somebody telephoned in and wanted to know what was the matter. There wasn't any news coming through, and they said, "Well, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Tulsa in the territory's got the floor," and they just raised Cain up there. They went on down to Louisville. And this Mr. Burkhart heard them, talked with them. So he came out and he started one of the early print shops. And he published one of the first directories, a little Woods directory in Tulsa, a little bitty day book type of thing.
My understanding on the time they stopped the Board of Trade that Will Rogers was with us. And that he had...
Well, no, I didn't have that in my notes, but it could be.
I got it from...
Well, we had several. Yeah. We had more than one.
That's right. No, but it was the one where New York called. I got it from Ms. Gubsher and her husband.
Well,
this might be of interest to you.
See, Judge Gubsher was the first county judge.
That's right. Uh-huh. But Judge Gubsher was a young lawyer at the time they made this first trip.
Uh-huh.
And Ms. Gubsher told me about this trip.
Uh-huh.
And I
got the picture. She let me have the picture of the train. Uh-huh.
But Will Rogers, she said, made this trip where Tulsa was here was the answer to the New York Board of Trade. I confirmed that with John Mayo because he had made a later one, and I called.
I think we had three altogether.
Yes. Now
that happened before I came the first.
Yes. John Mayo, the one he told about, was the one that was made right after SATA. That's the one they went to Louisville and a bunch of places on it.
Well, that's when Mr. Burkhardt came, and he'd been in the printing business all these years, and his daughter carried on up until about, I guess 2 years ago. She sold out and went into the marine supplies on the supply of the Port of Catoosa people.
This Goodwill tour, incidentally, will be in this Tulsa Town program tonight.
Oh, that's good.
With Ms. Gubsher telling about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's been here. She came before I did.
Yes.
She's married here. She taught out of Kendall.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Her old home is just a few blocks from where I live. Of course, she's down to Oral Roberts now.
She's just as active as you are.
Well.
She's painting and...
Yes, and she does lots of weaving. She writes for the weaving magazines, lace making.
But she also teaches and paints
I know. She teaches out there.
The day I interviewed.
I talked to her a couple of days ago.
Day I interviewed her, she had painted a picture that day.
Mm-hmm. I know she took a painting course in that famous painting deal that was started by Bennett Cerf, you know.
You think of anything else? We've had a good interview with you.
Well, no, I think that's about all.
So, is everything you know?
I don't know.
The rest will be in your book.
Well, one of the other printers here in town, Jimmy Cockrell, represented the printing industry on the national board for a number of years. My husband was president of the Tulsa Printers Association, and my son was. Now that office has been moved to Oklahoma City, I believe. But I was very well acquainted with all the printers and the printing industry.
You think of anything else?
No, I think that's all.
Well, this has been a wonderful interview with Ms. Mitch.
Well,
I
think I know this, down in my car.
Well, yes, this is an interview with Ms. J.O. I want to be sure it's correct. J.O.
Julius Obson.
Julius Obson Mitch.
Mm-hmm.
And we are looking forward to your book coming out.